Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. AI didn't just change how we work, it changed how we get scammed. My guest today knows that firsthand. Patrick Coughlin co-founded Savvy Security with his brother Ryan after their own mother was nearly the victim of an AI-generated voice cloning kidnapping scam. That experience turned into a company and now a book, Dark Side of the Boom: How Scammers Hijacked the AI Revolution. He argues that the AI threat isn't some far-off hypothetical risk. It's happening right now to real families at a scale we've never seen. Patrick spent more than two decades at the intersection of cybersecurity, intelligence, and emerging tech, building companies like TruStar and holding leadership roles at Splunk, Cisco, and Booz Allen Hamilton. This year, Savvy raised $7 million, congratulations, and launched its consumer app to help people spot scams before they become victims. So Patrick, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on all this. You must be the best son in the whole world. Your mother must love you more than anyone.
Well, it's quite a family affair now. As I think you mentioned, I co-founded the company with my brother, Ryan.
Right.
And so it's me, my brother. The origin story involves my mom. So it couldn't get more in the family.
Well, let's start there. Tell the story, because I think this is one of the biggest fears with AI, that more and more people will be scammed.
Yeah. I mean, as you said in the intro there, I've been working in cybersecurity for 20 years. I did work for the government. I've worked and built solutions for enterprises to protect them from nation state actors and from large scale, sophisticated cyber threat actors. But then about now, almost 3 years ago, my mom got one of these fake kidnapping scams, which, just to unpack it a little bit, she's sitting at home. She lives alone. My father died years ago in Kansas, and her phone rings one early evening, and it looks like it's coming from my sister, her daughter, who lives nearby. So she answers it. It says, Courtney calling, and she thinks she hears my sister's voice. My sister's saying, Mom, you've got to help me. They've got me. You got to do what they say. And then a man's voice comes on the line and says, you got to PayPal us money or else we're going to kill your daughter. And you can imagine my mom, 73 years old at the time, goes straight into mama mode. You know, she starts looking for her coat and her purse and trying to figure out, am I going to the bank? What the heck is PayPal? But by a sequence of events, she actually got lucky and got off the call. Once she sort of realized something just didn't seem right about this, and she wanted to call my sister's husband to check. And of course, when she did, she found out that Courtney was at home in the shower and that nothing about this call was real. And so by the time she called me, you know, while nothing about it was real, she was emotionally traumatized. I mean, she genuinely believed that, at least for a period of time there, that her daughter was in real danger. And so once we sort of calmed down and stabilized, I started thinking, Tammy, what the heck is going on in the world that now little old Beth Coughlin in Prairie Village, Kansas, is the target of a sophisticated, personalized social engineering attack like this? I mean, that's the kind of stuff I would see saved for like juicy government targets or, you know, high value targets at enterprises. And now it's coming at everyday people. And so that sent me down a rabbit hole, which I have yet to emerge from, which was a bunch of research into sort of the seedy underbelly of scam syndicates and digital fraudsters that operate from around the world. And that led to the book, Dark Side of the Boom, and ultimately led us to start Savvy Security so we can help build better protection for individuals and families in this AI era.
Okay, let's back up. So who was it? Why do you think they were targeted? Because to your point, you know, a nice, lovely lady in Kansas, she would not be the highest priority, right?
That's right. She is nice and lovely. But look, I think what's happened is AI in the hands of cyber criminals has made it cheaper, easier, faster, more scalable to target more people with more personalized content than ever before. These kinds of attacks weren't profitable to be pointed at consumers in the past because they simply took too much work. I mean, if you think about it, that attacker had to know my mom's phone number, roughly her address because they referenced a Walmart that was near her. They had to know my sister's phone number, my sister's address. They had to, you know, have some idea about what my mom's living situation was. They knew she lived alone, et cetera. So somebody did some work here, and then maybe they cloned my sister's voice. We were never able to confirm that or not, but we found some social media posts that showed us it would have been possible. So a ton of work is done here, and that takes time, energy, and effort. And the ask, I didn't even tell you what the ask was. They asked for $1,200 in exchange for saving my sister. And so what that tells you is somebody would have been ringing a gong in like a scam syndicate in Southeast Asia and high-fiving if they had gotten $1,200. That was the ask. That was the big score. And so you know it must have cost a fraction, a tiny fraction of that to actually execute that. And that's what AI has done. It has allowed at every stage of the scam, it has increased the automation and the precision of the convincing content that is used to get everyday people to become victims of these types of scams.
And so it came from overseas. You traced it back.
It was impossible for us to trace it with what we had at the time. And we could talk more about why this is so hard and some of the regulatory and incentive gaps in these platforms to actually enforce laws and what makes it really a challenge. But ultimately, you know, we believe it sort of had the trappings of an overseas actor. These types of scams originate from really all kinds of places, Southeast Asia. They come from Eastern Europe. They come from Western Africa. And they come from closer to home, too. There's plenty of homegrown organizations that do this as well.
So AI has just made it easier to screw everyone over.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Like now, you know, we can clone your voice from 3 seconds of audio from one of these podcasts, Tammy, up to like 99% accuracy. So all you need is 3 seconds of audio to create a voice. We can now create pixel perfect images that are impossible to distinguish what's real from what's legitimate to the naked eye. So we have like 200,000 years of biology that taught us, you know, seeing is believing and hearing was verification. Well, those senses are no longer valid in this AI era. What the attackers, what the scammers, what the cyber criminals are exploiting is that gap between where the technology has come and where we have all of this conditioning and biology that teaches us to believe other things. And until we close that gap with a mix of cultural changes and ritual changes and behavior changes and policy changes and innovation on behalf of the consumer, we're going to be in this mismatched war where they've got the upper hand.
Well, let's first go to some of the changes that would make a difference. First of all, innovation, because honestly, when people are talking about, you know, OpenAI, Claude, all the different kinds of things, it feels like there's some magic formula out there and that it may, in fact, help real people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was a big yeah. Like, sure, Tammy, you're living Yeah, I heard it. It's okay.
No, I'm trying to think about where to weigh in on this because I have so many thoughts. I mean, a lot of the conversation about the power of AI today feels so distant, like the good side, the bright side of AI feels so distant. If you go to middle America today, AI is a bad word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It is a scary word. Their experience with AI is in the sort of fear-mongering headlines. It's in these increase in scam and spam calls and messages and emails that they're all getting. And so AI doesn't have a halo in middle America, and it doesn't have a halo for everyday people. And I think part of that is because we talk about the benefits and the challenges in the context of the enterprise often too much. And if you follow the debate with OpenAI and Anthropic today, it's all about, you know, mythos and fable and the models that are coming out and can they find vulnerabilities in enterprise systems and can they help enterprise defenders protect against those vulnerabilities? And it's very much a discussion about the enterprise, which is an important conversation. Don't get me wrong. I think part of the point of the book, Dark Side of the Boom, was we should have conversations about the enterprise. We should have conversations about what AI does for government. We should think in a future way about whether AI will save us or destroy us or maybe just disappoint us. I don't know. But what I do know is that the data is impossible to ignore about what is happening to everyday consumers. Digital fraud, estimated losses in the last 12 months is close to $200 billion from Americans. It is the fastest growing crime in the country. It's now the largest economic crime in the country. It's growing at a rate that these numbers have never grown, by like 25, 30% year over year on these huge numbers. And these are numbers coming from the FTC and the FBI. These sound like the growth rate of like an AI chip company in the S&P 500, you know? And so the whole point of the book is to focus a bit of this conversation and the energy around what is really happening today, and to sort of take us out of the prophesizing and say, how can we control and mitigate the downside and the dark side of what we know is happening with AI today so that we can preserve the upside?
So what do you want government to do? If you could get government to do anything, what would it be?
Wow, what a fun question. I think government has a critical role here. It's going to ultimately involve the R word, which can be a dirty word in DC and around the country sometimes.
Right. Yeah, no one uses that. You don't live here anymore. No one uses that. There, you don't say safety. You don't say regulation.
Yeah, what do you say now? you use some other euphemism.
I say we don't say safety anymore. We don't say regulation. And I'm saying the both. That's the way we deal with it.
Well, whatever the hell we call it, we need a little bit more. We need more leadership from the federal level here. I mean, I think one of the challenges is we've got 1,200 bills moving through state legislators around AI governance. Maybe governance is a better word than regulation. And that's not the answer. I mean, if you know anything about technology and how these things work, like regulating them on the state level will only create a patchwork of regulations, which scammers love, because that just means there's gaps and loopholes that they can exploit as they move through them. And everyday consumers are just sort of, they're the ones who lose in that world. And so we need federal leadership and we need international cooperation. We just talked about how the origination of these attacks often comes from, I mean, more often than not, in the majority of cases, comes from overseas. And so, you know, we can't attack this at a local level, at a state level, and even necessarily just at the federal level. We have to do it internationally. And to give you concrete answers to your questions. So what do we do? One of the things that I advocate for in the book is know your customer, access to at least certain components of these models. So if you think about like API access, which is our ability to like execute a lot of queries and automation against these models, which allows scammers to run, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of the campaigns like they ran against my mom at one time. If we had some know your customer around that, if we enforce that, just like we do for things like buying fertilizer in bulk or buying Sudafed, the good stuff at the pharmacy, you know, you have to show an ID. If these models are half as dangerous as the people creating them are constantly telling us they are, then don't you think that we should create some more regulation around who gets to access them?
Well, it's funny you should say this, because one of the things that some in the federal government say, this is not a political statement, is that the existing laws, just to your point, know your customer, the anti-money laundering stuff, it's all there. It's there already. You just extend it to AI. But you're saying you're not really seeing that.
There's two sort of pushbacks that we constantly hear on this. One is like, well, it's kind of covered by the existing mandates. I would say if it was covered by the existing mandates, then you'd see enforcement actions against the companies who we know are violating them. Reuters published an amazing piece last year. They won a Pulitzer for it, where they basically uncovered through leaks and whistleblowers that 10% of Meta's revenue comes from fraudulent advertisers on their platform. And it's known, but it's a revenue control. And in fact, how they handle it is when they start to suspect a fraudulent advertiser. So somebody coming onto Meta and putting an ad out there for a fake product or a fake service that ultimately costs everyday people money that they don't get back, what Meta does is they'll start to increase the price of those ads as a control. Now, what that does is if you're a fraudster and you have deep pockets or it's profitable, you'll just keep paying. Mm-hmm. And so for Meta now, 10% of the revenue comes from fraudsters. We know it. They've said it. It's their most profitable ads, by the way, with the highest margins because they're the most expensive ones. But there's no regulation or enforcement around stopping that. And same with the AI model companies. And so if the existing regimes gave the tools required to change the incentives for these companies, I think it would be happening. So something's not right there. Mm-hmm. The other debate we always hear is, well, what about China? We can't slow down. What if we lose to China? You know, we can't afford that. Do you know who's incredibly ahead of the game in AI regulation? China.
China. I mean,
they watermark everything. They have a strict governance regime around their AI companies in China. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting we go that far, but if the debate is, well, we'll lose if we start to do regulation to China, China's doing an order of magnitude more regulation than we are. So that can't be right.
Yeah, it's true. We talk about the last conference where there was a signature on AI governance, not regulation, in the UK that China signed on. Well, actually in France too, they signed on as well. For the first time, I think the last few weeks that we've heard, you know, from Mark Zuckerberg, NVIDIA, et cetera, coming forward a little, Satya Nadella talking about something needs to happen. What do you make of that change? I mean, I haven't heard specifics, but what do you make of that change? Do you think that means that these company leaders are going to step forward, or is it just talk?
There's like a four-dimensional chess game going on right now amongst these handful of foundation model companies, or companies that have foundation models in the case of like Meta and their open source debate. I think they're playing a little bit of a dangerous game because, you know, they're trying to have a little bit of their cake and eat it too, which is they want to play up the immense power of this technology. If you're the founder of an AI foundation model company, you need to raise tons of capital. And so you need to convince everybody that this is an incredibly disruptive technology. And so how do you do that? One of the ways you do that is you talk about how it can fundamentally change safety, security, cybersecurity, war. These are ways to really like scare people about the power of your technology. And some of this is true, and it gets them to open their wallet. But when they do that, it has this effect where we say, well, shouldn't we control and govern these things then if what you say is true? And they say, well, hold on, we got to innovate now. We don't want to lose. And in the meantime, what they're not thinking about is the consumer sentiment. And so now that whole debate is happening at an elite sphere, but everyday people just hear AI is scary.
Right.
And so that's why you see people, you know, protesting data centers and throwing Molotov cocktails at Sam Altman's house, is because nobody's telling the consumers that this technology is going to be dramatic and changing and powerful. We're going to work to control the downside of it, and we're going to do everything that we can to preserve the upside for you. And so they've decided to not have that conversation. And I think the result of that is public sentiment is going to turn really south in this country around AI even more. Like right now, it's polling at 30%
right
in the US. In China, it's polling at 88%.
It's the best example, but I don't know how you change that point of view around. You're right, there's protests everywhere. You know, the state of Texas put out some compliance, the Texas compliance. We're going to force data centers to do 1, 2, 3, 4. To me, like data center, it is a proxy for AI. You can't say AI at all. We did our own poll for Washington AI Network, and you could say technology, but you couldn't say AI.
Interesting.
In this poll, critically, people would change their point of view on data centers if they got free Wi-Fi
yeah.
or they got something for it. You're actually pointing out the other piece, that most of the conversation is about the enterprise. It's not about how people live their lives.
So I think we can just center and position different parts of this conversation. And I think it will go a long way to changing the fundamental like narrative dynamics about this in the country. But part of that has to be a recognition that digital fraud is the fastest growing crime in this country. When I think about Washington, D.C., I think about, wow, what an issue that I feel like any side of the aisle can get behind stopping. I feel like everybody's got a story at this point. Tens of millions of Americans are scammed every year now. Like it happened to my mom. It's happening to people all around this country or people that they love. And so my only ask for Washington is to treat this like the crime that it is today. And I think what we would see is more action and more bipartisan action around this. And I think it's an issue that everybody can support. And we need a few more of those issues in Washington these days.
Well, I've got to say, Patrick, you've said it really well. A Dark Side of the Boom, an incredible book, How Scammers Hijacked the AI Revolution. I'm so glad to talk to you. I hope Washington is listening to you. And if not, you definitely need to come back and we'll drag you through the halls of Congress after the election to get this going. Because I do think we're at this nexus now of action or no action, because you're not going to be able to turn it around later.
Right. That's right. Well, thank you so much for having me, Tammy.
Well, thank you for writing the book. Good to meet you. Appreciate the work you've done. Best to you. I'm Tammy Haddad. This is the Washington AI Network. Thank you again, Patrick. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.